Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 15th of January 2008. Got Ian Purdy panelling, we've got Peter Vanderford over there, and myself, John Stapleton. Welcome to Dad's on the Air, and welcome to everyone who's joining us from around the world via live streaming. And don't forget, you can also listen to this off our website at www.dadsontheair.net, as well as the 2GLF website. So, a little bit of housekeeping first up. The .com site has a lot of particularly contentious... This is our old website. Dadsontheair.com has a lot of legally contentious material being placed on it at the moment, and we want to make absolutely clear to everyone that we have no connection whatsoever to the Dadsontheair.com site. As far as we are concerned, they are misusing our name, and we have no ability or power to stop the material that's being placed up there. So, there's a lot of news around. First up, divorce, peak season. This is the season to get divorced, according to Claire Weaver in the Daily Telegraph. She writes that feuding couples have inundated divorce lawyers after a surge in relationship breakdown over the Christmas and New Year period. It seems a great pity considering, you know, it's all meant to be about family and happiness. More than 10,000 Australian couples, including 3,000 from New South Wales, are expected to start divorce proceedings this month, making it the busiest time of the year for family lawyers. Crisis counselling services such as Men's Line have also been flooded with calls from people suffering stress and depression as a result of family breakdown. And statistics show that New Year's Day is the single most turbulent day of the year for families, with a 100% increase in reports of domestic violence. Now, of course, we've been very sceptical about some of these statistics, but
also in that particular article, it does say that it is 2-1 in favour of women wanting to break up their families.
Right.
Yes, so it is towards the end of the article.
Oh, really?
So it's actually being driven by women. It seems that the modern woman has decided that the family is not in her best interests, and women are basically seem to be destroying families as quickly as they can, running for their lives after Christmas.
Well, it's always been a very strong strain of feminism that, the family is keeping women and children trapped in these oppressive and violent situations.
Unfortunately, they don't have another plan. I mean, what's better than the family? I mean, what, this ridiculous situation where, you know, where every kid spend half their time here, half the week, or the daddy pack? I mean, this has been shown to not produce as good a result as the traditional family, I will say.
So there's a great advantage then for a woman to separate, isn't there, because they end up better off.
Well, if you consider the fact that they've got the CSA feeding them instead of a husband bringing home a pay packet every week, or both of them bringing home a pay packet. I mean, personally, I think the old traditional family is the way to go, but hey, I just must be old-fashioned.
Well, it's very ironical considering we're all separated blokes, but you will find that a lot of separated blokes are very strongly in favour of traditional families, I guess, because they've seen the results both on themselves, their partners, their new partners often enough, and their children, the devastating consequences of it all. Another story that's kicking around, this is from the Sydney Morning Herald. The Rudd government should appoint a minister with specific responsibility for children and youth, and a federal children and youth ombudsman in order to overcome Australia's abuses of the United Nations Convention of the Rights of the Child, a former senior judge said last night. There's Alastair Nicholson from the Family Court, who was there for most of its life. He was there for, what, 20-something years, was it?
15 years, I think, John.
I thought it was longer than that. Alastair Nicholson was the Chief Justice of the Family Court for a very long time, anyway. He really set the whole tone of the court, very much created the court in his own image. And he's called for a Bill of Rights with specific provisions protecting children, coupled with the introduction to the law of the UN Convention. And he said, we have seen over the 11 years of the Howard government, and don't forget that he was originally a Labor candidate and was always extremely left in his opinions, quote, we have seen over the 11 years of the Howard government a progressive trampling over the rights of all of us, including the rights of children and youth, the former Chief Justice of the Family Court said at the 21st Lionel Murphy Memorial Lecture in Parliament House, Sydney. What do you think most people would think about this?
Well, John, I think it's a bit ironic, isn't it, and the height of hypocrisy for this man to refer to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child when for 15 years he basically ignored and pushed for alternative views to those expressed in that convention, which we, Australia, it was a signatory to. And
the convention, sorry, very clearly states, doesn't it, that a child has a right to both
regular contact with both parents following separation, unless, of course, and nobody's ever discounted that children should be protected from parents who are not worthy, I suppose, of being parents through abuse of various kinds. But most of these guys, single and being without their children, are decent, responsible parents who are being separated from their children against their will. And this man for 15 years was promoting that. And if anybody stuck their head up and complained about it, he then referred to them as being failed litigants and not to be...
Yes, anyone who dared to disagree with these people, they're on seven, eight, 10 times the average wage here. These people live in a completely altered universe. It's clearly evident to anyone who's walked through the doors of the court.
Well, when he was appointed, Lionel Bowen, I think, was the Attorney General at the time, and he said he was very suited to be the Chief Justice of the Family Court. But when you look at his history, he didn't have a lot of family type of relationship bonding with his family, because for 8 years of his childhood he was actually spent in a boarding school away from his family. So
yeah, critics of him have often commented about that.
Exactly.
That's true. Yeah. He certainly left the court with an absolutely dismal reputation. It was in the basement as far as...
Amongst fathers. I think a lot of feminist groups think the court's just a fabulous institution and it should be the basis of everything in the world. It should all be that way. They should give everything to the women.
But what good does it do to have a public institution mopping up such vast amounts of money that, is so clearly and patently biased, or is viewed certainly by a large number of people as being very, very biased? So I don't think it does the country any good at all to have those sorts of institutions. Ask any lawyer who doesn't work in family law what they think. You'll soon find out that its reputation is very low indeed.
And I don't think things have improved a great deal, because even though individual judges make give orders along the lines of the new amendments, however, on appeal, that is often, those things are often thrown out and reversed. So, Ian, what have you got for us in the news today?
Well, not in today's, but in the Sunday Telegraph this week, an article under the heading, "The Lollies That Look Like Drugs, Parent Groups Outraged." Claire Weaver writes, "A Sydney company that manufactures lollies in pharmaceutical-style pill packaging has been accused of making drugs attractive to children. Drug and parenting groups fear the gimmick sends a dangerous message to young children who can confuse brightly coloured pills for lollies. Their warning comes less than 3 months after three New South Wales children were admitted to hospital after swallowing pills they had mistaken for lollies." So you've really got to say, the lolly makers, this is completely irresponsible. Parenting, I agree with the parenting groups. This is outrageous. It's a disgusting thing to do to our children. And it also conditions them later on in life for taking pills, which, is basically drug pushing, let's face it. Also in the Sunday Herald, was an article by Melissa Kent under the heading, "Juice Alert, Fruit Drinks Contain More Sugar Than Coke." Melissa writes, "The nation's love affair with fruit juice could be making us fat, experts say. Juice junkies who quench their thirst with supersized drinks might be shocked to know their daily refreshment has more sugar and calories than a can of Coke," which is absolutely disgusting. I personally got sucked into that for the first couple of years of my parenting experience. I used to go down to the supermarket and buy what I thought was natural juice, until one day somebody informed me that I should read what's actually in this stuff, and of course I was horrified to see how much sugar is routinely included in something that is marketed as juice, which it clearly isn't. And of course there's also preservatives, there's also colouring in there, which doesn't do anybody any good. And you know, all of the soft drink products, I mean, soft drinks are one of the 10 things that you should never put in your body. I mean, the preservatives, caffeine that they have in them, that they are really unhealthy, and really there's no time, no place for soft drinks, even though our society is awash with these drinks, and we do indeed give them to our children. And if we don't, of course, our children complain that we are cruel and mean, and the advertisers play on all of this. And it's something.
Oh, I know. You go to any supermarket around here and you see them trundling out with these great cartons full of Coca-Cola. The kids are all drinking Coke, which is the last thing they should be doing. It's just unbelievable.
Well, you drink a can of Coke, you get your daily ration of sugar in one hit. Mm. And if it wasn't for the suppressors in there, your body would immediately react by vomiting it out. But of course, they've set it all up so you don't vomit.
Not really a moment for legislation, but it's certainly a moment for a bit of public education. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking with family law maverick Simon Hunt, who is a very interesting and voice, certainly out of step with a lot of the other people in the family law reform movement, but a very interesting character indeed. We'll be back in a moment. talking with the very energetic, very entertaining Simon Hunt. Are you there, Simon?
Oh, yes, I'm here. Thank you very much for the introduction.
Oh, that's very good. You like being called a maverick, don't you?
Well, I sort of, I do and I don't, because, well...
Well, you
the
are.
Thing is, what I'm doing is trying to bring about shared parenting, trying to protect shared parenting, and really, that's what we're all trying to do.
Common sense is completely outside the square these days, mate.
Yes, well, I suppose it often is, isn't it?
It is. So what's your solution to the absolute mess which afflicts this country and certainly afflicts family law?
Talk about the problem. What we have here is this juggernaut of vested interests, being the social workers and the counsellors and the family court family courts and everybody that's making a buck out of this industry. One of the biggest problem one of the most problematic aspects of it is that all these government-funded vested interests that are supposed to be protecting women and children, a lot of them are sort of got this old-school feminist separatist idea, and they really see their job as protecting women at the expense of men. Now, unfortunately, because they're so well-funded, they pretty much control what the media writes, because they send them in press releases. They're getting paid to do that, and they do. And then the media is not able to report what really goes on in the family court because of Section 121. And so anything that any of us come out and states, any statements from anybody that's interested in reforming the family law, family laws in the country, gets hosed down by these press releases.
Oh, totally, yeah. Completely swamped. There's a tsunami of it. Hundreds of millions of dollars go to funding the other side of the equation, if you like, or the side of the debate.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter what we say. If we complain about the child support system, well, of course, we're deadbeat dads. And if we complain about the AVOs and the intervention orders, of course, we're abusers. If we complain about the massive amount of suicides being caused by the family law system, we're just whingers. I remember one lady got up and said, oh, the only reason so many dads are killing themselves is because we're better at doing it. You know, there's a terrible...
How's that for logic?
Yes, what was that? That National Council of Single Mothers woman, Elspeth McKinley.
At least they're prepared to acknowledge that men are good at something.
Yeah.
Killing ourselves.
Yes. So look, what I've done, I've been, working with this and thinking about this for the last 8 years. I feel like I've had a bit of a revelation here, because, we have to win the media battle, and it occurred to me that their main weapon is their claim to be protecting children, women and children, and when in fact the very complete opposite is happening. They're actually abusing children. And they're also abusing women, because women are being exploited by the family law courts and their practitioners. Any woman that goes along and says that she's having problems with a marriage, the first stop is the marriage counsellor, and of course now it's going to be the family relationship centres. And everybody tells her that her problems are due to the abuse of the father, of the male.
Have you heard any, just on a side question, any positive reports on these family relationship centres?
None whatsoever. It doesn't surprise me. I imagine, though, that there would be a positive outcome just by virtue of the very process of sitting down and talking rather than just sending solicitors' letters and affidavits at each other. But I haven't heard anything directly, no.
Right.
This is their claim. They claim to be protecting children. Now, we know that children sold parents suffer from several times more suicides and several times instances of failure academically and drug problems and mental problems, and it's a bloody disaster. But the thing is that all of these vested interests, all of the experts that oppose shared parenting, because none of the experts support shared parenting, because people that support shared parenting don't get government funded, so we're not experts. But they all agree that sole parenting damages children, right? So that's our chink in the armour. That's how we get in. We simply demand that children are protected from having one of their parents removed upon separation. So this is what happens now. Your wife kicks you out, or you move out because it's possible, and then you can't get to see your kids. The next thing that happens is you have to make an application to the court to see your kids. Well, what I'm suggesting is that the whole thing is reversed, that the children are protected from having one of their parents removed by the other, unilaterally. So if one parent wants to remove the other parent, she, and it's of course mostly the woman, has to go to court and put in an application applying for the removal of the father. Now, can you imagine if that was happening? How many women would go to that trouble? All the while, the kids are enjoying a relationship with the other parent, and then convince a court to have that other parent removed.
Yeah, but they would, because they get legal aid, and I mean anything to basically stick it to the man. You know, in those situations with a lot of emotional, you know, currents flowing everywhere, a lot of ridiculous, irrational, unstable decisions are made, and a lot of it is just a way of getting at their ex-partner.
Sure, and that's what fuels most of the problem. Now, I absolutely agree with you. There are going to be a number, you know, there's going to be still going to be women that go that actually go to the court to convince the court that one of the parents should be removed. But at the moment, they don't have to do that. It just happens at the click of their fingers. All they have to do is tell him he can't see the children, and if he complains about it, they get an intervention order, and of course that's invariably what happens.
AVO, accuse him of violence. And
it's a great irony, isn't it, that nothing could be more abusive, both towards your ex-partner and towards your children, than much of the conduct that we see today.
Well, that's right. So we're starting to move in that direction where there's this this idea that, you know, shared parenting's good for children, and these so-called reforms that have come in have all been sold in the media as a way of helping protect children from losing one of their parents and their relationship centres. So there's a bit of a mood. So the moment you bring in an order that works exactly like an AVO, so that the moment a parent finds themselves excluded from the children, they can go in and fill out the form at the window around the side of the magistrate's court, and it becomes immediately enforceable, so that they can see their children up to 50% of the time, and that's immediately enforceable by the police. Then it comes back, just like an AVO, to court if it's being opposed. Well, if it's being opposed, fair enough, the mother typically has to have evidence as to why she opposes that that joint parenting situation, or less if it's agreeable with the father, and she has to convince the court. But just to allow women to do it unilaterally and then leave the excluded parent in the situation of having to mount a legal case is just wrong. If it was turned the other way around, I believe that the number of women that actually went to the trouble to convince a judge, the court, that good parent should be removed, would be small and reducing because of the general acceptance in society that joint parenting is best for children.
I agree with you totally, Simon, and I think that's what something that's been lacking in the family law court in the orders, because they can't follow up on them. There's no compliance instrumentality at all. In America, incidentally, in some of the states, they do have something like that, and the police refuse to come and enforce those orders.
Oh, do they really?
Yeah, they do.
Really, on what grounds?
They say it's a civil matter and take it back to the court, basically. They won't.
It's unenforceable.
In reality.
Okay. Well, I would like to see children protected, and all of the media polls that I've seen we've all seen them shows there's over 90% in most instances support for shared parenting. So if we campaign, if we're sending out letters to the press, instead of complaining about women that lie in court and unfair child support arrangements, we say we want to protect children from having one of their parents removed, and not only that, we want to protect women from being exploited by lawyers and the other practitioners who tell them their problems are all due to the abuse of the father, because they're being exploited. These children are being damaged and the women are being exploited, so all the vested interests who get their power from claiming to support women and children, we pull the rug out from under their feet altogether.
We're all being exploited.
Sorry?
We're all being exploited.
Well, we're all ultimately being exploited, yeah.
We've been listening to... Sorry, Simon, we're out of time.
Okay.
We've been listening to Simon Hunt, his family law reform maverick in Australia, and it's all too sensible, Simon. It's all too much common sense. it's a long way from a dream to a reality, very unfortunately.
Well, if we keep on going, I think all our efforts to bring about such a situation, even if we're not successful, we're going to change, we're going to, you know, get there. We're going to improve the situation by degrees because we're going to concentrate the focus on children, and we're going to neutralise any attempt to brand us as deadbeat fathers or self-interested, which typically happens now because of their control of the media.
We can only hope.
Yeah,
that was Simon Hunt. He's a family law reform maverick in Australia. He's a very outspoken figure and often disagrees with some of the mainstream figures in family law and in the fatherhood movement in Australia, but he does a terrific job in putting alternative views forward. We'll be back in a moment.
You were saying, I live on all emotion, baby. I answer questions never maybe, and I'm not kind if you betray me. So who the hell are you to save me? I never would have made it, babe. If you needed love, well then ask for love. Could have given love, now I'm taking love, and it's not my fault, cause you both deserve what's coming now. So don't say your word. Wake up, call.
One of his nightly walks through the community, Hero Joe paused. He looked across at an average house cut up into small bedsits. The accommodation choice of the downtrodden, he told himself. But was there really a choice?
Hey, what you looking at? You some kind of prevert?
He looked through one of the windows and saw an average guy. A guy just like he used to be.
Idiot.
What the...
Don't worry about me. What are you doing?
I'm just internet dating.
Internet dating? Let me guess. That's the place all the people who are too busy to date meet up.
Yeah?
Normally I would hit you after a response like that. Let me guess again. Since your divorce, you found it hard to get back into single life. A wonderful life. But one that's foreign to the separated. A life where everyone you meet is a potential swinging partner, where every tree is mango-filled, ripe for the plucking.
Well, maybe.
Okay, let's have a look at the lady you're about to contact. You see, under the heading, in one word, describe yourself, she's written Brazilian she-male. That's two words, idiot. The key to dating is to meet people that share your interests, your passions, the things that give you go-go. Mm. Now, I know you're probably thinking bikinis and bouncing boobies. Mm. That's what you think you want in a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But listen to me. If you think like a monkey, you'll always end up swinging on a tire.
A tire?
What are you interested in?
Well, I like cars and beer and...
yeah, I can imagine the rest. Come with me. Beautiful. This is the perfect place. We have everything you like right here.
Hot dogs! Get your hot dogs!
I like the girls in the bikinis. I guess I can learn not to.
So what's your name anyway?
Osman.
Oh, that makes it harder. Not to worry. Come over here.
Hey, get out of my way! Can't you see how old piece I am?
Hey, Osman. She looks nice. You sit over there.
I guess.
Leave this to me. Hello there. I'm Hero Joe, and this is my good friend Osman.
Hi, I'm the real.
Hey, you got the tomato sauce? I got a hot dog there, cutting it.
Narelle, that's a lovely name. I once had a hamster called Narelle. You know what, Narelle? I love motor racing.
Oh, I do too. I used to come here with my boyfriend. We'd drink beer and watch motor racing. It was so nice. Then one day, he started drinking Chardonnay, so I dropped in.
Osman, it's all up to you now. Don't let me down.
Thanks, Hero Joe.
Ah, yes, true love. Like the great poet once said, ooh, ah, who wants to fight when you can get some tonight? And as Hero Joe moved through the crowd on his way to the next citizen in need of his help, he lamented over the mishmash of humanity before him. A motor-fueled frenzy of people dining on beer and hot dogs, a gaggle of gassed-up guzzlers. He reminded himself of how far we'd all come from swinging on tires. You have been listening to the Independence Jones Radio Playhouse in association with the Dulwich Hill Men's League. Be sure to tune in again for the next power-packed episode of Hero Joe!
This is the way you left me. I'm not pretending. No hope, no love, no glory, no happy ending. This is the way that we love, like it's forever. Then live the rest of our life, not together.
Wake up in the morning, stumble on my life. Can't get no love without sacrifice. If anything should happen, I guess I wish you well. A little bit of heaven, but a little bit of hell. This is the hardest story that I've ever told. No hope, love, or glory, happy ending's gone forevermore. I feel as if I'm where you stand. And I'm where no rest, keep walking around. If I pretend that nothing ever went wrong, I can get to my sleep, I can think that we just carried on. This is the hardest story that I've ever told. No hope of love or glory, happy endings gone forevermore. I feel as if I'm waiting.
In this week's show, we look at the burgeoning men's shed movement. There's nothing new about men gathering together in their own space to talk, share skills, swap ideas, solve problems, or just discuss life in general. It's been happening since the beginning of time. There's nothing new either about men spending time in their backyard shed, an acknowledged Aussie pastime. What is new is that men, particularly retired men, are combining these two activities in a communal space simply called a men's shed. What is also new is how strongly men have embraced this new identity, being a member of a men's shed. Men's sheds as such are a peculiarly Australian phenomenon. In the past decade, a wide range of community-based men's sheds has sprung up, each with its own unique identity and purpose. Activity within sheds are many and various. Woodwork, metalwork, restoration of old cars, portable sheds taken to Alzheimer's facilities or mobile sheds to remote country areas. The membership is diverse too. Men from all backgrounds, ethnic and social mixes can enjoy a men's shed, bringing their unique cultural characteristics to enliven the activities.
I'm here in Manly at the second National Community Men's Shed Conference, and I'm here with Professor Barry Golding from the University of Ballarat. And Barry was co-author of the most comprehensive study of Australian men's sheds, called Men's Sheds in Australia, Learning Through Community Contexts. Now, so Barry, welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, for our listeners who aren't familiar with men's sheds, could you start off by just giving us a general outline of what men's sheds are all about?
I guess listeners know about backyard sheds, and they're obviously popular and almost iconic for a lot of men in many Western countries. So they look a little bit like backyard sheds, but the difference is they're actually in public spaces. They're in community settings, and it's not for one man, but it's for many men. And so they're places where men can come together and make things on a regular basis. The pretext is making things, but the sort of subtext is friendship and companionship and reducing isolation and loneliness. That's probably how I would say it. It's mostly for older men. So if you were to walk in, it looked like a workshop. It's a woodworking workshop or a metalworking workshop mm-hmm. with tools and a space in the corner to make a cup of coffee and a table in a separate area sort of down one end where they can have lunch and have a bit of a chat and tell a few jokes.
Okay, and you'd find a bunch of guys, mainly older guys there, they'd be making stuff, chatting while they're working,
yep.
Catching up, yep. Socialising and that's the general scene?
That's basically it. And in terms of age, when we say older, based on our research, half of the men are older than 65, half are younger than 65. So it's not... There are some young men, and there are some sheds who are doing some really interesting stuff with disengaged young people who are boys and girls who are primary school and secondary school. But again, it's run by older men.
Right.
They're actually very diverse. There's some sheds for men with dementia. There's sheds for men who are Vietnam veterans. There are sheds for men in aged care contexts. There are sheds for Aboriginal men. There are sheds for men on community-based corrections orders. There's sheds in country towns that basically take any man who wants to come, who can range from sort of 25 to 95, and every age in between. Men with a disability. There's some sheds just for people with a disability. So they're very diverse. It's not one size fits all. It's just as you know.
So it's fitting in with the needs of the community that in which the sheds operate.
Absolutely. And being grassroots there, they basically, no one says what they have to do. If a group of guys and importantly, there's some of the sheds are run in part by women.
Right.
So it's not as if it's just men run by men. It's although in the shed itself, although there's a few women involved in some sheds, it's largely a men's phenomenon. But there are women who are often getting the funding and doing some of the organisation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this national conference has been run in large part by a committee that includes Ruth Van Herk, who is very much a woman.
Yeah. from the Lane Cove Men's Shed,
and she's done a great job. So I mean, you know, there are women at the cutting edge of it.
Mm.
But I think the important thing is a recognition of particular needs for men.
So how many men's sheds are there currently in Australia at rough count?
It's a bit of a movable feast, but I'm estimating that at the moment there's around 200 sheds open or very soon to open in Australia, and that's increasing all the time. Probably 18 months ago there was probably 100 sheds, so it's probably doubled in the last 18 months.
And with that sort of growth curve, does that mean that men's sheds are quite a recent phenomenon? Were there men's sheds at all 20 years ago, for example?
If anybody understands what exponential means starting really slowly and rising with a whoosh.
Right.
And there's been a few sheds around as long as 15 years ago. There were probably 10 years ago, there were probably half a dozen sheds.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 5 years ago, there was at least two or three sheds in most states. And it's gone whoosh. But interestingly, it's mainly Southern Australia.
You don't find so many sheds in Queensland or the NT?
If you draw a line between Newcastle and Perth, most of the sheds are south of that line. Now, there's not a rule that says men can't be north of that, and there's some interesting sheds like ones in Nambucca and Grafton, and people are setting ones up in Queensland. But I just had a chat to a lady in the bus on the way back from the conference this afternoon who was from Brisbane. I said, what's wrong with the men in Queensland? there's nothing wrong with the men in Queensland, for those of you listening, but it's there's something about Queensland. I suspect it's a little bit about the climate. I think it's a little bit hotter in a shed in Queensland.
Yeah, that's true.
People are probably spending more of their time outside fishing or down the coast or in their boat, or there's more of an outdoor lifestyle. Mm. Whereas in places like Tasmania and southwest of Western Australia, and where I live up in the highlands of Victoria, it's bloody cold. And being in a shed's actually quite a cosy thing to do.
And I guess if one of the reasons why the blokes like the idea of the shed is to sort of get out of the house for a while, if they're already out of the house in Queensland, fishing and with the warm weather, then maybe there's not such a need to sort of...
Maybe that is it. And your point about getting out of the house, I'll just pick up on that, because that is really what a lot of these men are doing. Someone joked this afternoon at the conference, they said... this is a joke, but someone said that men's sheds are like daycare for fathers, or daycare for husbands, for older husbands. They're not exactly that, but I think there's what sociologists call underfoot syndrome, which is the idea that if you marry someone, for better or for worse, you don't necessarily want to have lunch with them every day. That's what underfoot syndrome is, that you need a life, you need a social life, you need networks beyond your relationship, and you have to, in a sense, have an independent life at some stage during the week in order for the relationship to stay sound and for you both not to go crazy. On the other hand, there's about a third of men in these sheds who are men who are on their own, and without the shed, they would be staring at four walls. And so it's the push is different. On one hand, it's the underfoot syndrome. On the other hand, it's getting away from the isolation. So the attraction of the shed is the same, being with other men, companionship, regular hands-on practice. Someone said last night at the opening of the conference that men, there's this myth that men don't talk to each other, and he said men do talk to each other, they tend to talk shoulder to shoulder rather than face to face. And I thought that was a really good way of putting it, and that's what happens in the shed. They're actually, while they're making a boat, or they're making a plane, or they're making a coat, something out of wood, there is a lot of important stuff going on. There's a shed near where I live in Creswick in Victoria that has just done a little booklet called Tales from the Shed, which is actually very powerful, where it's actually stories from the guys in the shed. And I've got a friend who I've tried to turn on to the idea of sheds through my research. And what I write as an academic leaves him cold, but I actually sent him a copy of this Tales from the Shed. And he wrote back last week and he said, "Finally, Barry, I get it. I'm turned on to it, but it's not what you wrote, it's what the men have talked about." So there's something about men's experiences that obviously aren't authentic in the way I write my research. I mean, I tend to hide people in the averages. And so I can say this group, that group, whereas once you get to that, I mean, every man that comes to a shed is a person.
And they each have their own story.
And once you get to that story level, that's when it becomes very interesting and very powerful.
As life goes on, I'm starting to learn more and more about responsibility. And I realize that everything I do is affecting the people around me. So I wanted to take this time out to apologize for things that I've done and things that haven't occurred yet and things that they don't want to take responsibility for.
Sorry for the times I would neglect. I'm sorry for the times I disrespect. I'm sorry for the wrong things that I've done. I'm sorry I'm not always there for my sons. I'm sorry for the fact stay busy till you heard from dad. When you would rather be home with all your kids. It's one big family with love and bliss. And even though pops treated us like kings, he got a second wife and you didn't agree. He got up and left you there all alone. I'm sorry that you had to do it on your own. I'm sorry that I went and added to your grief. I'm sorry that your son was once a thief. I'm sorry that I grew up way too fast. I wish I would have listened and I'd be so bad. I'm sorry that your life turned out this way. I'm sorry that the feds came and took me away.
Professor Barry Golding from the University of Ballarat. I've often observed that men often find socialising easier when they're doing some hands-on activity together rather than, I guess, inverted commas, socialising for socialising's sake. That if there's an activity they can do together that is, in a sense, the purpose for them getting together, then the socialising arises naturally out of that. It's a more comfortable environment for some men.
And in a sense, it doesn't matter what it is that they're making, whether they're making a boat or whether they're in a male choir. They're all sort of like a men's shed in the sense that they're doing something together, but as a consequence of that, they form trusting relationships as a group. And that's when the magic starts to happen.
Mm.
It's that informal, in a sense, the activity is the pretext for a whole lot of other much more important stuff.
Mm.
Like, you know, what's happening in your life, what's happening in your relationship, what's happening to your body, what's happening as you age, what's happening to your children. And if you've lost aspects of your health and your relationship and your home and you've lost your job and you've lost your identity as a working man, or you've simply lost your identity as a young man and you're having difficulty coping with being an older man or being a grandfather or living on your own or whatever, I think a lot of this is about men adapting to change.
And supporting other men through the change.
Supporting each other through the changes. Mm. And that's, in a sense, I think that's the nub of it. And I think that's why it attracts a lot of older men. I think while a lot of people in midlife are just coping with children and all that sort of stuff, and they don't have that need to I guess they've got other ways of coming together, but I mean, retirement can be really frightening for a lot of men, and so can separation, and so can loss of health or libido or family or all sorts of things can knock men for six.
Which brings me to my next question. I'm trying to, I guess, get to the nub of why this movement, the Men's Shed movement, is flourishing so much, you know, now in the early 21st century. And is it because male employment patterns in older age have changed over the past few decades, so that older men are more likely to be either unemployed these days or retrenched, therefore more likely to suffer from loneliness and isolation and depression, those sort of things, and therefore there's a need for this, whereas perhaps older men may have found some of this bonding and social life in the workplace in earlier times? Has there been a change in the demographics of employment? That is?
A whole range of things have changed. Men are living longer. They're still living 7 years less than women, but they're more likely to spend more of their retirement. And there are also many men are falling out of the workplace before the formal age of retirement. Many have been damaged by the work process. Their bodies have been damaged, their minds have been damaged, and many men don't want to work anymore. So the myth that somehow there's all these people who are going to suddenly go back into the workforce, well, some of them will, and those that want to, I really hope they do. But some people are over being exploited. I'm not saying all men are exploited, but a lot of people have been exploited, and their bodies are buggered. And some of them, their minds are buggered too. And in many cases, their relationships and their families are buggered. Just through life's, you know, some people have been dealt a pretty rough hand.
Right.
And, but I guess the other thing that's changed is that, you know, I'd say if you'd talked about a men's shed 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it wouldn't have been acceptable to talk about it. I think men have suddenly realised it's actually okay to talk about having a place for them, and I think they would have probably found it difficult to argue. And even when I started my research in this area 5-6 years ago, there were people who said you can't talk about groups of men who are disadvantaged. And I said, well, why can't you? I'm not saying that all men are disadvantaged, but there are some men who are experiencing difficulty, and all of the health stats and all of the suicide stats show that.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I think it's become more acceptable to talk about it. And I think suddenly people have, and this is what fascinates me about the men's sheds, the, you know, community-based men's sheds, is that men have suddenly got a license to come out. I'm not talking about come out as gay men. I'm talking about come out of their backyard shed into a social space. That would have been unthinkable 10 years ago for most men. And yet today at the conference, people were just so powerfully moved by what they've experienced as a consequence of being involved in this. And people come from all over Australia for this. It's the, you know, it's men my age and older. I'm 57, and I reckon that most of the men are older than me. This couldn't have happened 10 years ago. It wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. There's something happened, and I think it's not just that men have got a license to do it. I think they're being encouraged by women to do it now.
A couple of months ago, I was part of a delegation down in federal parliament. We were lobbying some politicians there. There was some of the Labor shadow ministers were there. There was one prominent female Labor shadow minister who, when we were talking about this sort of stuff, she's a baby boomer. She came through the feminist generation. She's a strong feminist. And you could actually see the lights suddenly switch on. And she said, I finally get it, that what you men are going through now is in some ways what we women went through at the start of the feminist movement. We needed a space to get together as women.
Absolutely.
And I think that change in some women in seeing that point of view has been really beneficial.
We're doing, and when I say we, this is Mike Brown and Annette Foley and myself who have done the national study. We're just writing a paper called Houses and Sheds. And, And we're actually drawing some parallels between what happened with the neighbourhood house movement in Australia and elsewhere in the 1970s, where women came together and, in a sense, created new spaces. They didn't call them women's houses, but in effect, many neighbourhood houses became women's spaces, run by women, ostensibly for women, created specifically for women. But because of equal opportunity, they've never been named as women's houses. They've been called neighbourhood houses.
Mm.
The difference now, and men are always slow learners, I can crack that joke myself being a man, men are about sort of 25 years behind. But 25 years later, what I'm saying is that men have sort of had an aha moment where they've suddenly said, not only that we can create spaces for ourselves, but we have a responsibility to do it.
Right, for the benefit of us, our health, and for our families, and for our
but
women.
But it's not for us as individual men, it's for men generally.
Mm.
And again, that's what fascinates me about this. In a sense, it's like a men's movement, but it doesn't come out of any particular masculinity. It's mm-hmm. It's coming about men talking about being men, being blokes. So it's sort of like if I can put it this way, it's a bit like a working class masculinity. And that's the other interesting thing about this. While there are some university graduates amongst them, it's largely an ex-tradesperson's working class movement.
Mm.
And they're often men who've had quite negative experiences of formal education, who wouldn't normally be seen in an organisation that, as I've recently identified, and this is the extreme irony in the whole movement, is that they're organised as collectives, where non-hierarchical decision-making bodies. I'm not saying they're feminist, but in many ways the principles under which the Men's Sheds movement is organising is probably closer to some of the feminist collectives of the 70s.
Mm.
And yet they're very different.
Mm.
The only difference is that it's for men.
We're dazzled.
Here with Professor Barry Golding from the University of Ballarat. So are many older men's needs and problems currently not being reached or served by the existing institutional forms of education and training? If you say that these working class men are coming to the shed because they felt alienated from other forms of education?
Yeah. I would argue that, and the evidence shows that adult education, aged care and health services generally tend to be female professions. The spaces that are created in aged care centres and in adult education centres tend to be like where we're sitting in this interview room, tends to be carpeted, they're clean. That's not to say that men's sheds are dirty, but they're different from a normal classroom. They're more likely to be outside, they're more likely to be a little bit cluttered. They're more likely to be more like a workshop than a kitchen or a classroom.
Mm.
And a lot of men feel more comfortable in that environment, particularly working men.
Mm.
And I guess to answer your question, I would argue that the ways in which we've catered for men have tended to, if we do provide services for such men, we tend to see them from a perspective as being clients with problems, in parentheses. And I'm saying that the men's shed organisations are tending to be organised around men who are members and participants, equal members and participants, who are sharing in the activity and the experiences. And so they're not coming from a deficit model.
Mm.
They're coming from a strength as men of experience. And that's the other important thing, is they're not old men who are buggered in terms of their life. They're men who've got something to bring to other men and to share. So in a sense, they're bringing wisdom, they're bringing a lifetime of skills, they're bringing a lifetime of experience. And all of these men have had lifetimes of relationships, their families, three quarters of them are fathers, 60% of them are grandfathers. I mean, these are men of experience.
So are there many opportunities then for mentoring within the men's sheds, but from older men sort of passing on their wisdom to the
other? Absolutely, and that's the way it works. Again, our research shows that men enjoy the opportunities to mentor each other rather than to be taught or to teach. They want to be in a comfortable place that feels like home, where they can do stuff informally. There's actually some parallels, and I've done previous research in rural fire stations in Australia, and I'm actually arguing through the evidence and the research that a lot of rural fire stations, while they're not called men's sheds, they function in much the same way, where they're places where mainly men come together for regular hands-on.
And these are the volunteer
ones. Fire brigades.
Right.
And there's more volunteer fire brigades in Australia than there are primary schools.
So
they come together every week or every fortnight or every month, training and practicing and meeting to cope with emergencies that actually rarely happen. So you could say, well, what's it all about? But on top of their training, they're actually I live in a small community in Victoria, and the fire station is by far the most important organisation in town. It's not a men's shed, but it functions in many of the same ways. And so people have lifetime of friendships now. They're not directed specifically to men, and there are a lot of women in fire brigades too, but my point is that men's sheds aren't new. Well, they are new in one sense, but they're not new because men have been meeting in engine preservation societies, railway workshops, plumbing departments of TAFE colleges. So in a sense, there's a lot of precursors to men's sheds, just that they haven't been named community men's sheds.
So are men's sheds particularly Australian phenomenon? Have you looked overseas? Are blokes doing this, or maybe they're not calling themselves blokes? Are men doing this in Canada or the US or
well,
Europe?
I'm lucky to have this year been to Canada, New Zealand, Sweden, England, Ireland and Scotland, and I'm looking to set up an international project looking at men not in work. And I can now say that community-based men's sheds, as we talked about in the interview, don't exist anywhere else other than Australia. There's a couple of Kiwis I've come across from Hamilton in New Zealand to check out what's happening here, and they can see that sheds are similarly iconic in New Zealand, but no one's really thought about doing something. I would argue that men always find somewhere to go. And have always found somewhere to go. And if you go back 30 years, it might have been the pub. In some places, it might have been the fire station. And in Scotland, it's the Crofters Association, people who graze sheep up in the Highlands.
Right.
And in Belfast, where I was, it's the men's clubs that, that stunningly were actually recruiting grounds for the paramilitary. So, I mean, men have met in all sorts of different places in all sorts of ways for reasons other than coming together. But I guess my point is that it's not that men don't come together. They do come together, but they come together in different places in different cultural contexts. And many Maori men, for example, have carved boats and carvings and stuff in their workshops. And in Papua New Guinea, men have come together in their community houses, in a traditional sense, to the men's houses. So I'm not being essentialist here, but I'm saying that, in a sense, men have gathered in places that are sort of a bit like a men's shed in other cultural contexts. It's just that they're not quite like the sheds that we're seeing in Australia at the moment. This is something new. I do believe it's got... I mean, men's health stats are diabolical in other places. In Glasgow, men live on average, in many parts of Glasgow, the age expectancy is 57. And this is because of hard working lives because of pollution, because of alcohol abuse.
Mm. Poor, you know, probably poor nutrition.
Poor nutrition, mm. all sorts of stuff. So the issues that men are dealing with, older men are dealing with in Australia, are similar in many other developed countries, in Canada. You know, and as you probably realise, many Aboriginal men, many Maori men, mm. many Inuit men in Canada are experiencing, and there are some very interesting sheds developing in Australia, community-based men sheds, which are dealing specifically or on particular days for Aboriginal men. So there are, and there are sheds in Melbourne which are dealing with issues associated with men from the Horn of Africa, from Sudan, and
right.
and
yeah.
so and there's workshops tomorrow on men from different cultural contexts, from Vietnam and from mm. other places. So it's sheds mightn't have been iconic for Sudanese men in Sudan, but they are a place where men can come together in Australia with other Australian men who were born in Australia and sort of share and I guess learn mateship and learn what mateship's mm. about. Because mm. I think one thing that stunned me when I went overseas, the extent to which we in Australia, particularly in rural Australia, do have voluntary community-based organisations is quite stunning.
Well, the Surf Lifesavers are another great example.
I mean, mm. someone said today that almost everything in Finland was paid. Even the community workers and the people who were holding the microphones at conferences were being paid. And that's what's stunning about this particular conference. I mean, a lot of these men have driven across Australia in buses and are staying in backpackers. Or have, you know, travelled up by train and or the cheapest airline they can and come by, you know, bus, boat and ferry. Mm. And some guys didn't arrive till lunchtime today because they simply couldn't afford to fly like I could. And a lot of these people have paid their way up. These are volunteers.
Mm.
They're not being paid to come to this. They've come by a wing and a prayer from all over Australia. And that's also quite stunning. That's how much they believe in this. And so many of the key people in this movement are doing this voluntarily. The whole Australian Men's Sheds Association has been run voluntarily. It's quite stunning.
Working all night long, put my daughter on my knee, and she said, "Daddy, what's wrong?" She whispered in my ear so sweet. You know what she said? She said, makes me wonder why.
I'm here in Manly at the second National Community Men's Shed Conference, and I'm here with Professor Barry Golding from the University of Ballarat. Now, I believe one half of men who attend men's sheds aren't members of any other community organisation. I was reading your paper last night.
Our research does show that, yeah, half of the men who come to sheds, if it wasn't for the shed, they wouldn't have anywhere else to go.
So what is it about the shed then that's so important for men that men perhaps aren't getting through other social opportunities like going to the club or the bowling green? Or what is it that they're getting that's essential to the shed that they're not getting elsewhere?
I think that many men, and particularly many working men, have spent their lives, working lives, with other men, working in groups, in friendships, in mines and in factories and in rural settings, working with other men.
Mm-hmm.
And in retirement, they lose the contact with men. Men aren't the greatest social organisers. Men who are in a relationship have often got a wife who's a social secretary.
Mm. And then in the workplace is their default social secretary, I guess.
It is. Mm. And so I think people find themselves quite lonely and quite isolated in retirement, and they get quite a shock. And I think that's probably an important factor in all of this.
Mm. Do many of the men's sheds have problems with making the sheds sustainable if it's run by volunteers and sort of scratched up out of nothing? What are the problems that some of the sheds may encounter in keeping it running?
Okay, some sheds will start up and close down. All sheds find it difficult to get going. It's hard to create a safe space to meet all of the occupational health and safety, dust extraction,
mm-hmm.
making sure your machines are safe, making sure that the people who use the bandsaw know how to use the bandsaw without cutting mm-hmm. their arm off.
Mm-hmm. Especially with older men who may be losing some sight or some hearing.
There's all of those. Mm-hmm. So making a safe space, getting the funding is just huge. Getting the funding, making them safe. You don't need a heck of a lot of money, but you do need money. You do need a space. You need fire extinguisher. You need a lockable place. You need to make sure the gear is safe. All of that is quite time consuming. Now, there's two ways of doing it. One, you could say, well, let's give them the money and let's build a shed for the men and then get the men to come to it. What I actually said today is that's a mistake. The key is to actually get the men first. And for the men to create the shed, because I've seen in a couple of cases people have got the money for the shed and a small number of men have built a shed or some number of women have built a shed, and then they've said, now what are we going to do with it? But the men haven't been part of creating it. I guess the story I'm telling is suggesting that it's the journey that's more important than the destination, and people learn from doing it. It doesn't matter how many men come, it's not what they've created, it's what they've learned from doing it. And in a sense, it's that journey to create.
Not the shared experience that they have.
The shared experience of creating it is much more important than actually the end product, which is the successful humming, running shed. So I would actually, anyone who's thinking of setting up a shed, put them in, find the men who want to make the shed, and get the men on side to create it with you for those men, rather than creating the shed and thinking, well, what are we going to do with the shed now that we've built it? That's a mistake. And also a waste of money.
Absolutely. A waste of very scarce money, probably.
Yeah.
So one last question before we go. Men's sheds often provide a good opportunity to give important health messages to men.
They do. The proviso is that if you call them the men's health shed, I suspect men wouldn't come.
Mm.
I think if you called them the men's learning centre, men wouldn't come. I think the health message has to be subliminal. Some people call it health by stealth.
Yeah.
And men who are in a shed will submit themselves to a diabetes check. If a doctor comes to the shed, they'll be delighted if he comes in and does their blood pressure and checks them for diabetes and does a talk about prostate and whatever. Men in the shed will listen to anybody come and talk about anything. they're delighted to have people come down and talk, including about health and to do, you know, in an informal way. But if you foreground health, or if you foreground learning, or if you foreground fitness, or if you foreground well-being, there's much less likelihood that people will actually come to the shed. My argument is you always make... I mean, I've got a colleague who works in a community learning centre, and he describes men as... He says men are funny bloody cattle. He says... he basically says that men won't cross the road to do something... They'll actually find a long way around to do something. And there's a researcher in the UK, she's actually said men earn, women learn. And she's actually arguing that women are better at changing their stripes as older people and adapting to change through learning new things. Men, when they're in a tight corner, tend to work harder rather than working smarter. And so, in a sense, they just tend to do more of what they've done in their lives, assuming that just that putting their head down and putting the blinkers on and just working harder will actually work. Women, in general, I think, are better at adapting to change. And I think that's probably a key. And in rural communities, this tends to happen. Men will often kill themselves, literally, by working themselves into the ground, trying to beat the drought, or trying to beat a changing market, or trying to beat, rather than just sitting back and actually thinking about it and thinking what I'm producing is not actually working, and then actually putting more fences in or putting in more crop as I've been doing for 20 years is not actually a good idea. I'm actually going to have to learn something new or do something different.
Well, I think I've often observed that you could almost call that stubborn-mindedness or linear focus of men. It produces Einsteins and it produces Leonardo da Vinci's, because you need that focus to reach those heights of brilliance, but it also can lead men into quite destructive behaviours like you're describing there.
And into quite dark spaces.
Right.
And for me, the lovely thing about a shed, to come back to the shed, is that it's not a dark space. It's a place where, if you are feeling dark, someone's going to lift you up. And so it's, you can come to a shed with despair, but you won't leave with despair.
Well, that's a wonderful note on which to end our chat today. It's been lovely chatting with you today. Thanks so much for taking the time to come on Dad's on the Air today, and all the best with your work.
And I hope anybody who's listening is interested will go to, well, find out more about it, but there's actually a website. It's www.menshed.org, and you'll find a list of all the sheds across Australia, information about the conference, how to start up a shed. So if there's people listening who think, yeah, I want to do some more with this stuff, that's what to do.
That's a good starting place. So www.menshed.org.
That's it.
Fantastic. Thanks once again, Barry.
Good to meet you. Thank you.
Cheers.
We're dads on your...
Go, Maxie.
We're dads and our kids.
You'd never guess it was school holidays, would you? That was great. Okay. Sorry. Well, thanks so much to Professor Barry Golding from Ballarat University for an excellent interview, and particularly like to thank Greg Anderson, our researcher, who has done a wonderful job with that interview and has done a wonderful job since he's come on to Dad's on the Air. He's also done an absolutely terrific job redoing our website, www.dadsontheair.net, which has been completely redesigned, and do have a look at that. You can download the program there. It'll be up, unlike the days of old. It'll be up in about 24 hours or less, should be up later today, and you'll be able to listen to that again. It is a fascinating subject, men's sheds and the creation of private spaces for men, which is a really difficult thing, particularly as they're so fundamentally excluded so often from public debate and particularly policy formation. Terrific. I'd like to thank Ian Purdy, who's been doing a terrific job over there on the whatever you call it, the panel thing. I'd like to thank Peter Vanderford, who's also done a wonderful job doing a lot of the computer work and the pre-records, and myself, John Stapleton. Well, I won't thank myself, but I'd like to thank everybody else who's contributed so solidly to the program. We'll be back next week looking at a number of different issues. One of the things is a new book on Liam McGill called Days of Tempest, which is about the paternity fraud, and that should be a particularly interesting subject. And we'll also be looking at the whole apprehended violence order system, and there's people advocating that the AVOs be taken out against parents who are running around sporting fields egging on their kids and fighting. But we'll be back next week.